Please welcome Ursula Owen.
Hello, everyone. I'm really delighted and honoured to be introducing two such fine poets. They're going to read about half an hour each, Denise first and then Vani. And I'm going to introduce them together now, and then I'll disappear. Denise Riley is an admired poet as well as a philosopher and feminist theorist. She was born in Carlisle, initially wanted to become a painter, but instead studied English at Oxford University and then philosophy at Cambridge University. Her work began to be published in the 1970s. Critics have praised her for being a thinker of great originality, working at the intersections of creative writing and phenomenology. She has the most extraordinary capacity to make abstract intellectual questions vivid, pressing, and personal, using everyday speech and pop culture to powerful effect. The relationship between her academic and literary work is clearest in her engagement with the topics of language, emotion, and identity. In her poem, A Part Song, which won the Forward Best Single Poem Prize, her voice is strong and beautiful, but her subject is not strength. She is simply robust about frailty, with colloquialisms that continually surprise. She writes with great certainty, beautifully about doubt, and never reverently. In 2014, she received the Society of Authors Chumley Award for Lifetime Achievement in Poetry. Say Something Back was shortlisted for the Forward Poetry Best Collection Prize, the T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize, the Costa Poetry Award, and for the Griffin International Poetry Prize. And incidentally, in Say Something Back, please read the notes to the poems at the back. They're poems in themselves. She's Professor of Poetry and the History of Ideas at the University of East Anglia. She's been writer in residence at the Tate Gallery in London and has been awarded visiting fellowships at several American universities, as well as at Birkbeck College in London. She's taught continental philosophy, art history, political philosophy and poetics, as well as creative writing, and she lives in London. Her writings are famous for their paradoxical interrogation of the self, particularly in her poetry. Her books of poetry include Marxism for Infants, No Fee, Dry Air, Mop Mop Georgette, Selected Poems. Her critical writings about the history of feminism and the philosophy of language, War in the Nursery, Am I That Name, The Words of Selves, Impersonal Passion, have made hugely important contributions to these fields. Denise Riley raised three children as a single mother. Her chapbook, Time Lived Without Its Flow, reflects on how one's perceptions of time may be altered after the sudden death of one's child, and why inhabiting this new temporality stops one's habitual modes of telling and discovers an intimacy between time and language. Vani Cappeldeo has lived in England since 1991. She's worked in academe, been an OED lexicographer, and did a DPhil in Old Norse at Oxford University, where she was a Rhodes Scholar. Her published books are No Traveller Returns, Person, Animal, Figure, Undraining Sea, which was shortlisted for the Guyana Prize for Literature Caribbean Award, All Your Houses, Dark and Unaccustomed Words Utter, Simple Complex Shapes and Measures of Expatriation, which won the Forward Best Collection Prize. She's been a research fellow at Girton College, Cambridge, was the first poet on tour for the Out of Bounds Poetry Project, and is a contributing editor for the Caribbean Review of Books and a contributing advisor to Black Books Manifold. She's worked as a volunteer with Oxfam and Rape Crisis. Her performance and installation work began during her Judith E. Wilson Poetry Fellowship and includes responses to Euripides' Bacchae, Radical Shakespeare, and the revolutionary Guyanese writer Martin Carter, when she also explored collaborative work
and immersive events.
Landscape, language, memory all inform her poetry and prose, largely those of Caribbean, Indian, diaspora, Icelandic, Scottish and Northern cultures. Her forceful intellect is revealed astonishingly in her prose poems. She offers multiple perspectives on colonialism and migration and ideas of belonging. Working across adopted voices and loose poetic forms, she examines, amongst other things, the expatriate's dilemma, not so much displacement, but a refusal to be placed by others, rejecting the easy depiction of a person as a neat, coherent whole, embracing a self grounded in complexity. In the end, as she says, language is my home, not one particular language. It is alive other than in speech. So please welcome Denise Riley and Varney Capavere.
Ursula, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. Thank you also to the organisers, especially the sandwich makers in the hospitality tent, who have absolutely valiant. And as far as Vala goes, thank you all for turning up on such a hot evening. And again, thanks to the organisers of the festival for having me here. It's my first time in Ledbury. Normally, I would also mention to you that I'm very pleased and very lucky to be the warm-up act to Varney Capadeo. But for reasons you'll understand, we're all thoroughly warmed up already. I will start with some recent work, which is either unpublished or has flitted across internet publication somewhere. I'm a reader who tends not to talk between poems unless I feel that there is some quick bit of explication which may make the thing more intelligible to you. And so I'll do that, not often, only very intermittently, but with the first piece that I'm going to read, where I nicked the title from the Roman writer and natural historian, Lucretius, who somewhere in his work has the line, all as a rule fall towards their wound, or sometimes the translation says, the wounded fall in the direction of their wound, which of course, if you think about what it would be to be harpooned by a Roman spear, which was then dragged away, you would indeed fall in the direction of the wound. But I've borrowed that sentiment to talk about the question of how you might cope with various senses of injury yourself, how you might choose to describe or back off from describing those. And I've taken as a raw material of this piece the works of 14th and 15th century Italian painters of saints who were very often depicted with the instruments of their torture in the paintings, but frequently the instruments of torture are coolly and serenely depicted. The only tiny fact that I'm sure you'll all remember is that a white lamb often appears as the emblem for Saint Agnes. So all as a rule fall towards their wound. Sheathed in their amber, dove grey, olive silk, saints clutch a grill or wheel, pincers or spear. Calm heads, anointed by the buttery sunlight, inclined to these instruments of their torture turn to starred yet unvarnished blazons as cloak strip carmine and rose velvets glow. Here the raised axe is no more than its action. It hands the decapitated to their merciful rest. Would it help me a bit to stroke its mild blade, take the edge off old violence, though not gild it later, announcing that, blessedly, I survived? What hope is there of a purely secular grace? Attend, Agnes, your white emblem's bleating. Unlike, this was a poem written in memoriam for Tom Raworth. It's called Unlike because Tom had a very clean and driving style, far from my own convolutions. Unlike, appalled yet flexy as a marionette, remoulded far from children and from men, it tries itself before its own star chamber, recoils in stammers, cannot answer she. In mounds of rainy violets, no aid hides. Court of itself condemned, admits no plea of how she tried so hard, or what the petals saw from their quite harmless rosette of leaves. Lone Star Clattering, which did appear in Poetry Review. What got done to me stains through my hopes of passing as fully human, though my, quote, bad blood, unquote, won't gloss that. To canter around its crimson rosette would tart up a harm more my post-war bad luck than a told shame's mother. Still, the pose, say, yellow rose, go hard and plain to Amarillo. They have shot me down. Yet, do I rise? A tad orange. Woman on train in August. And the woman on the train in August says the following. I was alive, but I paid for it heavily. Oh, fair enough, although my coin was sex-specific. I kept such tenderness later in both hands and nowhere could accept it. Now, easing by this railway cutting, rife with buddleia snouts, bull terrier profiled, solemn white, crinkled in mauve, or rusting brown at cocky angles, we will shortly be arriving at Tail Parochial, where our journey ends, all our belongings. Time, how short. And this will be the last of the unpublished or very recent pieces. Time, how short. What does your wordless absence say? Who are they for, those promises? Nothing was true if now all's gone, though it was, wasn't it? Serious. Hopes denied recoil to stiffen like glazed weeds tangled under ice. Time does not always heal the damage, but tamps it down, then seals it tight. Ears and mouths must close on quiet, whose patient night gapes in appeal. Willed silence is a short-lived luxury. Speak as you can, and while I still can hear. And I'll flip back to a short piece from an earlier collection altogether, which only convinces me that I've spent 50 years writing essentially the same poem with minor variations. Lyric. Stammering it fights to get held and to never get held, as whatever motors it swells to hammer itself out on me, then it can call out high and rounded as a night bird's cry, falling clean down out of a black tree. I take on its rage at the cost of sleep. If I love it, I sink, attracting its hatred. If I don't love it, I steal its music. Take up a pleat in this awful process, and then fold me flat inside it so that I don't see where I'm already knotted in. It is my burden and subject to listen for sweetness in hope, to hold it in weeping ears, though each hurt each never so much. So a few from Say Something Back. Maybe, maybe not. When I was a child, I spoke as a thrush. I thought as a clod. I understood as a stone. But when I became a man, I put away plain things for lustrous. Yet, to this day, squat under hooves for kindness where fetlocks stream with mud, shall I never get it clear down in the soily waters? Tree seen from bed. The fuller leaves are ridged, the newer red. Sunshine is pooled over them like lacquer. One branch catches a notion of movement, shivering, then the rest cotton on, in a rush roused by the wind, to thrash and vacillate, a toss-up where they'll all go next. To lash around through summer until autumn, that is where to fall. May it be managed lightly, though it could well turn wilder beforehand. Tree, watch from my sick bed, read to me, read from the hymnal of frank life, of how to be old yet never rehearse that fact cosily. And now a bit of cheerful nonsense, which is called Clemency. Sweet goose, fat on springs, fine ideals hiss in a lime sauce. Clemency's glow is rueful, citrine-veined, then always ends up being about practical kindness. Don't tut. That's brilliantly green and airy, and will frog march some right round under the blinking sun. So, look lively. Under the answering sky. I can manage being alone, can pace out convivial hope across my managing ground. Someone might call later. What do the dead make of us that we'd flay ourselves trying to hear them, though they may sigh at such close loneliness? I would catch, not my echo, but their guarantee that this bright flat blue is a mouth of the world speaking back. There is no depth to that blue. It won't bring the principle of darkness with it, but hums in repose as radiant static. I see a couple of people at least have got copies of this book, so for anyone who happens to have it, I'm going to go to page 26, when we, of the hymnal, When We Cry to Thee. And in fact, Jane Clark, who is one of the Irish poets reading very beautifully this afternoon, made mention of the fact that there is a perhaps generational adhesion to the meters of hymns which survive despite one's lack of complete, in my own case, as it happens, lack of faith. So this is When We Cry to Thee. Stout voyager put out to a black sea, I had no mother, yet still I have become one. Marine, I'm sick inside this single darkness. Inky swell, carry me. Hymns, ancient and modern, buoy us up, though I am faithless. I will go on to page 29, Silent Did Depart. A spirit casts no shadow. True, of the filmy dead, not of a living creature tapering itself to an obelisk, rocky mute, life's too serious for this not speaking. Don't be stuccoed so hard over any humane seepage. What had been churning around in that ardent pillar? You'd not have dreamed an upright man could petrify. Drape my anointing hair at the feet of superb cement. All hindsight shakes itself out vigorously like a wet dog. And on to page 30, with child in mind. And the child in question isn't an infant or an ordinary child of any kind. It's the surname of the compiler of those very fine and very useful collections of Scots and Border ballads. So it's Child the Ballad Anthologist who is in mind here. With child in mind. And when he came to the broad river, he took off his coat and swam. There were reed beds, whistling, smoke, burning somewhere on the rainy wind, far along the sobbing wind. Get away with you now. And on page 32, listening for lost people. Still looking for lost people, look unrelentingly. Quote, they died, unquote, is not an utterance in the syntax of life where they belonged. No, belong, reanimate them, not minding if the still living turn away casually. Winds ruck up its skin, so the sea tilts from red-blue to blue-red into the puckering water. Go his ashes, who was steadier than these elements. Thickness of some surviving thing that sits there bland, its owner's gone, nor does the idiot howl. While I'm unquiet as a talkative ear. Spring heat, the cherry trees, fresh bronze leaves, fun out in gleam. To converse with shades, yourself become a shadow. The souls of the dead are the spirit of language. You hear them alight inside that spoken thought. On page 35, a very short piece which borrows its title from William Blake, I told it not. I told it not. Tap in this bland October, that cedar's ripening cones, piped pinkish green along its lower branches, tap until their pollen spills to writhe in bright lime powder coils. This, frankly, panto, jealousy makes it such a lurid tree. And page 37. And another thing. Some new arrivals coming, whose name may not be happy, attended. Childishly lovely wants to listen to anyone new, as if even the oldest harm was outgrown as a liberty bodice, does sifting through damage ease or enshrine it? How grasp a past but not skid on embittered accounting? The ledgers exhibit their black surplus malice and red lack of tenderness, while, quote, suffering, unquote, easily gets competitive as each suspects hers was the rougher lot, yet feels shy out of shame at her history that won't dovetail with her present. Hoist personalised flags, though they're so stiff with encrusted blood, they'd first need a good sousing in tears. Forget that. Could the years have been easier if you just settled early on hating a sex instead, or lo, which one of them to begin with? Sleeked up your plumes to swan out and ruffle your usual vexes of dailiness, filed reports to the muses via cicada surveillance on men who weren't wrapped, only dozing in warm grass at noon, lulled by music to dreaming their sonic enchantment is virtuously militant, a sparkly art stance plus a strong civic end in itself. It's late. You must live as you can, which is all we ever did. Go on to page 39, catastrophic thinking. It will to be ordinary, easy as rain sifting through woods, but doubt shrouded that mind, skewing its aim at mildness. Fires were lit, and sap hissed in young branches torn down by anxiety, contorted to shield itself, biting its angry hands. It smoked out each transparent joy. It strode well away from its heart. Darkness absorbs any mind once it starts calling itself unwanted. I'll go on to page 47, lines, which is called Lines Starting with La Rochefoucauld, and indeed the first line and a half comes from that very useful and sympathetic French author of Maxims. So La Rochefoucauld speaks, and he says, "It is more shameful to distrust your friends than be deceived by them." End of his quote. "It is more shameful to distrust your friends than be deceived by them. Things in themselves do hold, a pot, a jug, a jar, Sweet William's green shank shins, so that your eyes pulled clear of metallic thought by the light constancy of things that rest there with you or without. That gaily deadpan candor draws you on, your will to hope quickens in their muteness." As several of our readers in previous sessions have been engaging in or talking about eco-poetry, I'll read a piece on page 49, which is called On the Black Isle, and was indeed written on the Black Isle in Scotland, but which demonstrates my own failure at the genre of eco-poetry, because what's happening inside this particular piece is that the poem is having an internal dispute with itself. It's arguing with another bit of itself about what it is anyway to write about place. So it's answering itself back in a rather sardonic manner. So it sets off in earnest vein and then loses that earnest vein pretty quickly. "Three ginger temples of oil rigs clamped at the bay's mouth, a big navy sky roiled over cloud pillars. The notebook goes riffling through its colour chart. Four, rose-flushed stonework, cut clean as these rain-beaded fuchsias, or until that notebook, a mental one, flips round to inquire whitely, just what do you think you're up to? Answer, any gay thing's worth a chase for as long as its shade distracts, so drape far rain hung in cinematic swathes. Its next reproach isn't appealing either. So, where am I in this? We aren't. This is in rosy chromity, its broad fields racing by and silvery, ruthless rain nettling our scarred skins. Quite vanished and never said why. Thick kelp straps gleam in the shallows and loll on the rising tide. I'll read on page 51, a man, quote, was stood there. And why was stood is put in quotes, is that I was very struck by that completely inexplicable moment a few years ago, when instead of simply saying standing, somehow everybody was writing and saying was stood or was sat. So a slightly mysterious new passive term had raced everywhere like a virus. It's fine, but why did it spring up and seize the field so quickly? I don't know. So a man, quote, was stood, unquote, there. On pitted sand the urchin shards fan out, but the watchers, braced in shingle, wet grit, scraping around ankles rammed in an undertow, rack fronds whipped on skin as he senses himself, raced faster than pebbles, grinding toward the rising water, while his feet stream out behind him in a moonwalk. You'd get rushed backwards just by standing still, he'll muse, catching a tiniest roaring underfoot. But what thought does he find in that sound? Or purely his dizziness on being rolled away from the sea, as one lost to his naturally rocky balance that he'll recalibrate now at the core of a man, quote, being stood, unquote. And I will, I think, just read a couple of more pieces, one of which is very short. It's called, on page 53, An Awkward Lyric. It sits with itself in its arms, out of the depth of its shame. It starts singing a hymn of pure shame, surging in the throat. To hold a true note could be everything. Getting the hang of itself would undo it. And I'm going to stop with Death Makes Dead Metaphor Revive, which is on page 62. And this is another place where I borrowed the meter of late 18th and early 19th century writers of hymns of the like of Isaac Watts. Death makes dead metaphor revive, turn stiffly bright and strong, time that is felt as stopped will freeze its to fro song I parrot under feldspar rock sunk into chambered ice, language the spirit of the dead may mouth each utterance twice. Spirit as echo clowns around in punning repartee, since each word overhears itself laid bare clairaudiently. An Orphic engine revs, but floods choked on its ardent weight. Disjointed anthems dip and bob down time's defrosted spate. Over its pools of greeny melt, the rearing ice will tilt. To make rhyme chime again with time, I sound a curious lilt. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here, and hello to the rather beautiful dog, which is almost in here. Almost, but not quite. This is a poem about some lambs which are at Tibraden, outside Dublin, farmed by Colin Graham, whom some of you may know as @19acres on Twitter. Early lambs, born some hours ago, curls canaled, crimson-ridged, too new to agitate, won't stick heads through the well-adapted fence or wait on treats, but stay, succeed in standing, funny, fuzzy, valuable wedges, cave painting, hand-smoothed treasures, a fine sound, the ewes bellowing, a hybrid flock, individual faces, strength in the legs, warmth in the shed. A hybrid flock is not a political point. It's that Colin is actually breeding the very technically named speckled ewes with polka dot faces. The next poem comes out of a project which was called Poetry and Paintings at the museum in question being Oxford, where I lived for about 25 years, at the Ashmolean Museum. And a few of us would walk around, and if something seemed to begin speaking to us, we'd write about it, and then we'd put on slightly anarchic free tours for the public, where we'd read the poems and talk about the things. And the museum never actually wanted to put these tours on their website, because they were, you know, we weren't charging anything, and we didn't really go in order. The last night, a nightingale, red-vented bulbul, gouache on paper, early 19th century. You begin with a design. The artist strokes a kind of preening that elicits frictive glosses from your close-up wings. Whoever drew you also caged you. This freehand desert color time box, partly pinkish, like your eggshells. Through a set of lilac lines and dawn and dusk, you look sideways. Sweet, invasive, and entirely silenced thing. I've company to place beside you. Not yet. Passerine bird in your passage from Persian to English, you're no longer a nightingale, though you'll warble and curl your toes. While you perch, I'm minded to bring you a tree and a night and a song to be yours. The memorable one flung out by your namesake from a moonstruck twig. That time our deaths were forecast on the news. So we went for a walk and rested in you, oh, everything lyrical forever. The next three poems come from the Out of Bounds Poetry Project between the Universities of Newcastle and Stirling, which was a place poetry project based on the Blood Axe anthology. The place poems were by black and Asian British poets who were not necessarily writing about finding or not finding saltfish and mangoes in the corner shop, but simply had rather intense reactions to real and imaginary places, like Raman Mandir, who writes in Shetlandic, and so on. So I was writing about the Antonine Wall, which was built in the 2nd century CE and ran from the Forth to the Clyde. What was quite unusual about this wall was that the Romans paced south-facing distance slabs at certain points along the wall with terrifying pictures of themselves killing Celts, basically. But what's rather odd is that they seem to have been working with Celtic artisans, because there's a lot of sort of Romano-Celtic influence that you can see in the carving. And what's even odder is that some of the people they're killing have got very, very ancient Roman hairstyles, because they were left over from how people would cut their hair in Wales. You can see some of these in the museum in Edinburgh and in Glasgow as well, where you can see bits of the wall at Falkirk and so on. The Antonine Wall, 1. Rome's northwestern frontier, invitation to civilization. By the way, they get the Latin a bit wrong because they're from all different bits of the empire. Imp Caesar's invitation to the ballista ball, by way of white lead acorn-shaped sling bolts, arrives via red-hot correspondence personally stamped, launches like a no-shit eagle wreathing overhead, promises ornate south-facing distance slabs, burnt wheat. Come on, for ages some of you have aped our style. pleading continuity in Ciceronian Latin taught at your good school in Wales. You look Celtic and sound dead. We were hardly dancing when, from the Forth to the Clyde, 37 miles evenly with our differing feet, Roman contingents of Syrian archers, Roman bands of Tungrian horsemen, we paced off or measured squares. Now from within the water-to-water wall patrolled at sky height and from the adverse mouths of platformed fires, we, between micaceous sandstone pillars, glittering, ready with an ecumenical Flaminius, you, wild, solitary, crafty, literate tribes, invite to a civilization. You understand? Stone flows from the hair of snakes where Gorgon's heads adorn both knees of Mars advancing. You're still good on the ground. Two. Romano-Celtic contact in the Antonine display, Hunterian Museum, Glasgow. I want you like I want a wall. I want you in bits. I take you underground, your masonry in pieces. I remaster roundhouse from square fortlet, souterrain from taxgate. Farmers find pillars that retreating you through down wells, covered with small fittings, nails, capitals, building debris. If litter and landfill were the sum of your legacy, I'd not trouble myself to collect slabs that you cut sometimes with my hands, so stone-fledged warbling, nor myself, another trophy in this Hunterian hall, flay time where stone seems just setting from a recent fiery tear, Roman bones like gaming counters, corralled in a jar. Before I read the third and last one in this Roman set, I should thank Stephen Fowler for commissioning this for the Old Enemies dialogues and say that the other half of the dialogue was written by Jeremy Noel Todd about various East Anglian stones. And the whole thing's on YouTube. Thank you very much for not filming things and all that right now. Fortuna with Cornucopia, found at Castle Carrier by canal workers in 1769. It is a wall they raised, thrice the height of rational houses. A wall or a wave, is it? Turf atop stone coursework, tidal disastrous atop tilled fields. Was it fortuna to guard stonily liquid the soapy Romans? It was fortuna they carved. She was their luck to light on, to fall from. She was someone you once knew at home. Now, if you were actually to go and find some Roman glass, you might think it was left over from Habitat or somewhere, because what's quite odd about it is it was very, very bling. The pillars were bling, the micaceous sandstone glitters. The glass was amethyst and emerald and blue. It looks very modern, very artificial. And I don't know what you... It seems to have been an exercise in soft power, that wall. It's not like Hadrian's wall. It really was mostly turf, which is why there wasn't much left. And they're very luxurious bathhouses. You can see the remains of one at Bear's Den. So you could imagine being a shepherd trying to take your usual path, which ought to be able to cross a certain track, and then suddenly finding a lot of naked Romans gambling. It would be a little bit off-putting. The next poem's not really explicable in except when you read it, so you have to wait until next year if you want to. This one is commissioned by Sidekick Books for their Catullus responses, and I'm responding to Catullus 5, where he's counting up how many thousand kisses he's giving Lesbia and then how he'll erase them all so that people can't envy how many they've had. I was asked to respond in Lesbia's voice. Was a time, Catullus, I'd indulge your counting fetish. Relay how long a pause I'd need, ascending stairs to bed. Squidge, wipe, repeat. Sensation strigiled my declining body, switched on hypersensitivities to linen thread count, not to say stone, till skin inclined to flinch from sucking discs remora-like, which swarm from any contact, every surface. You write when you cross, sharp, silk. You're a cultured man, dressing made to measure, rubbing those bronze balls on your abacus, spittle-kissing mercury on your practice mirror. As for me, I'm lying, open, beautifully open, to a tease of a beautician's innumerable tweezings, laughing with the blonde from Gallia, who lays her head low on my belly while she tends my lady garden. Occasionally I'm asked to do something called mentoring, which is very, very strange. I shouldn't say this, but I don't really know how it's supposed to work. So I was mentoring a poet and performance artist much senior to me, Maya Chowdhury, whose book has just come out from Peepaltree, the Leeds-based press. And we went around looking at things in various places, such as gardens in Edinburgh. And the next three poems are for Maya. They're sort of eco-poetry, but hers is the real deal. Moss for Maya. A child left alone can befriend moss. Its bright green, enticing to the eye as a lemon lolly behind the teeth, makes moss seem to shine in the darkness under lizard-haunted exora bushes and on the killing patch of concrete to the disaffected workmen splashed on earth that had been alive with wet-combed roots. As if extermination were necessary for human habitation and moss an infiltrator. Moss has not tiny tongues, nor little fingers, nor flames fine as watchmakers' tools, nor an elfin semaphore system. Moss is not lickable, not glossolalia, not in the way on the way. Moss is myriad, simply many and one. Moss absorbs. For the benefit of giants, 14 kinds of Icelandic moss were exhibited under glass, including the static flicker of a moss named for its resemblance to white worms, a name mistranslatable as pale dragons. It must have been plucked from the cooled, flowing lava fields that look like nothing, yet where detail thrives. Clumps of pink carnivorous daisies, trapping zippy insect life. The life cycle of moss is momentous. Any given colony of moss could have been there since whichever chosen beginning while changing at a rate that puts mammals' eyes to shame. Don't slip. Grab the balustrade. Don't slip. She's broken her arm. Don't scrape too much off. It's beautiful. Bleach it all. It's a risk. Coexist. Moss exists. Our stone selves roll on different tracks, unmatchably cracked. We cling, resist, shape to our ends whatever is. Not this. Moss induces words in us. Because grave and new we sentence things, whereas moss carpets, respires, pulls back, is. This is the second of three from Maya. It's another prose one. Orchids from Maya. Said the text, man made an image and likeness of God. By implication, animals apart, not apart. Distanced, unlike, not dislike. Useful, supplicant ever, not to cross into dead, into food. Supplicant, supply, succulent, yet man, sick, rages and ravishes his sick likeness out of every bit of the palpitant breath-holding world. Will palpate a breast of stone to tear out heart's blood, hematite. Will pursue a roaming softness till it yields a shielded being, hermit crab. Overtopped by wondrous flowers, will dig for tubers and find testicles, orchis. It's his sick fantasy. Voila, the bridal orchid, coyly masculinized at its roots. And I was not a namer, was not Abrahamic, was a traveller, was metempsychotic before meeting that word, was unworlded and reworlded Indianly, soul by soul, which I, it, did not believe, yet I, it, passed this present consciousness into those things that mattered, because I, it, was placed before them to wait, as a child waits and changes while, because, waiting. Before I, it, caught the trick of rising out of any situation like soluble particles, I, it, would go for all or nothing, for the narrative voice, for characterless bounding atmosphere. So, this orchid, it, not I, is outside. I, not it, crush up against the words for it, the seeing a saying, the display a don't touch, as a wanting face and sexy hands flatten against shatterproof glass, making this human spring a reflection, this vegetal yearning for connection always pluckable, already englobed, a singular narcissus healed by a soapy panic, a stark desire clouded by echoing aldehydes. I, it, am built to be the outside. Oh, to take it in, it is. Three orchids, yellow tintinabulation high up in a tent in Trinidad, a sweeter chime before the prize-winning frightening yams, first time this word orchid thing. Three orchids, the second knowable as a quiet and agile slight disruption, snake-like to the line of a tree's bough, spider-like in being mottled purple-green, another colour too, not chestnut nor livid, just vitally deep, nameless colour of orchid flesh, orchid who by sprouting silently to us, though perhaps not silently to all sorts of differently sensing things, living at different pitches and paces, orchid who therefore makes this garden a space, though walled up to a point, after that point, open air, something goes, anything grows, wild. Three orchids. Disconnect, served, snapped, aphrodisiac on the edge of a dish, a challenge for mauve-balled males. What have you come to? Third forest flower. Jammed with tines, Thai cuisine, art supplement opener under artificial night. Here's the third one in the sequence from Aya, and after that I'll just read two more short ones because I think you should read things from books. Seed from Aya. The voice of the seed. You said, as yet it has no voice. The seed, perhaps ever, a star, a trap, a tropism, a keep, a wrinkle, a tide. These voiced words, not so sweet stone, so liquid seed. The second to last one is from Utter a.k.a. the one with the jaguar on the front, by Stanley Greaves, the Guyanese artist and poet from Peepal Tree Press in Leeds. Calling Time. When he said, look at the lakes, I heard one thing with my head, another with my body. It was a hot day. The talk had been geological. Only my feet were constant, weeping blisters, statuified in Gore-Tex. The whole way, whatever we saw, plinth, plateau, ravine, his words effaced, levelled, chiselled, explaining them in terms of something else. Waterfalls modelled as once existing would have rainbowed. The lakes. Look. Dearest, do you remember not being drunk, walking the straight line of sheer overwork, and the city tilting? Well, like that, I administered the narrow path of my deep need. Somewhere below, the ants, crow, cacti changed in the heat. The gently muscled water called attention. I sat and called time. Something rushing past forced my eyes shut. So in purple-black conscience of the quite empty blue sky, I figured an airplane collision. The lakes not looked at, picking up cobalt, left their rock, ripple-morphed to missile, not underpowered Renaissance arrows. Direct the hit had fared, which would see me running out of myself, running out, coming to an end, not looking where all waters go. A hot day, there reigned a catastrophic indigo. Now, the last one in which a deer dies, I'm sorry. Actually, I'm not particularly sorry. It is a sort of eco-poem, as the person it's about takes part in the ecological cull very responsibly in Scotland. Stalker, he waits. Without knowing me, he waits. The tips of branches, edible and winy, bring spring by suggestion to him who in autumn dawn, eager with wet knees, disregards me, being drawn by me. He waits, and in me he waits. I branch. The form is branching. It bounds like sight from dark to bright, back again. The form is from me. It is him, poem stag, first sight and most known. In him I wait, when he falls. Needs must, hot heap. Nothing left over, tree-like no longer, nor forlorn. We're totaled. Thank you so much.